Welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. His name is Nick Wright. They call him Chris Canny. With Week 10 officially in the books, we got a lot to discuss. The Cowboys and the Eagles sit tied atop the NFC East. Who's got the edge there? We'll discuss. Why is Tom Brady saying his team needs to ramp it up, even though they've got the best record in the AFC? We'll discuss. And what an incredible NFC West showdown last night. Let us discuss. Monday Night Football, Russell Wilson and the Seahawks taking on the undefeated Niners in the Bay. Pick this one up in overtime. That's how close it was. Seattle was in the red zone. Russ's pass there, you saw it picked off by Dre Greenlaw. Greenlaw returns his first career interception 47 yards the other way to get San Francisco to midfield. After Jimmy G got the Niners in field goal range, Chase McLaughlin with a chance to be the hero. But he was not, as his 47-yarder was wide left after both teams traded punts. Seattle's Jason Myers, he had a 42-yarder to win the game in overtime for the Seahawks. Seattle handing the San Francisco 49ers their first loss of the season. What a game on Monday night. Here is Russell Wilson after the win.
That was the craziest game I've ever been a part of. I mean, you know, talking about a Monday Night Football game, it felt like NFC Championship game right there. Just back and forth, two great teams going after.
There are no longer any undefeated teams left in the NFL this season. Chris Canny, we'll start with you. How did the Seahawks win this game?
Well, it was with defense. Now, I know a lot of people will point to the late game heroics by Russell Wilson, that third and three that he had on the third possession of overtime when he has the 18-yard scramble to set up the Jason Myers game-winning field goal. But, I mean, it's really about what this defense did throughout the course of the entire game and in overtime. The ability to survive four turnovers by your offense and still have a chance to compete. I mean, the last time that happened in the NFL was week one, where the Buffalo Bills survived four turnovers against the New York Jets. And when Adam Gase is the play caller, you can understand why the Bills had a chance in that game. But I mean, ultimately, it's about the defense of that Seattle Seahawks. They shut down the 49ers run game. They held them to less than 100 yards rushing, 3.2 yards per carry. And that's because of the defensive front led by Jadeveon Clowney, who had his best game as a Seahawk. And then Quandre Diggs, the guy that they traded for from the Detroit Lions, the safety, he showed up last night with an interception that led to a touchdown in that third quarter. But their defense constantly put them in positions to be able to be competitive in this game. Their defense was the one that first got them on the board. You had the strip sacks, which Clowney recovered and returned for a touchdown. Puna Ford showed up in the run game. Jaron Reed, who missed the first six games due to suspension, he had his best game back in the four games that he's played
Griffin
this season.
Jack Griffin made a great play late in overtime.
Great play.
Looked like he was
beat. Also had an interception that was called back early on in that game. But, I mean, everybody for that Seahawks defense had been flying around. So to me, you got to credit that group who's been trending in the right direction the last three games. They've held their opponents under 100 yards rushing, seven takeaways. That to me is the story about last night's game.
Well, and I'm glad you focused on Seattle's defense, and I know we're going to spend a lot of time today focusing on Russell Wilson, who, even if the stat line doesn't show it, aside from the one interception that we played for you in the highlight, he was brilliant throughout, despite being under constant duress, despite having a really tough whistle go against them in multiple spots. He was the best offensive player on the field for either team. But the other reason why Seattle won this football game is because Jimmy Garoppolo was playing quarterback for the other football team, and he was dead set on turning the ball over as much as possible. He had three. He could have had six. Mm-hmm. He was clearly skittish in the pocket, especially late. You could count three, and I would argue four, easy dropped interceptions from Jimmy Garoppolo, and an interception that was called off early in the game that you alluded to on a very questionable defensive holding call, one of the many questionable calls that went against Seattle. This is why, even at 8-0, some of us were a little hesitant to anoint the 49ers as not only the best team in the NFL, but I'm not even sure about the best team in the NFC. And after last night, you're not even sure about the best team in the NFC West. Like, the Niners also had a very curious coaching decision late in this game when Seattle did something I couldn't believe. They're chasing the Niners in the standings. They are trying desperately to catch up. They punted the ball away with a minute 50 left in overtime and no timeouts. San Francisco, at that moment, was guaranteed a tie if they wanted it. Mm-hmm. They could run the ball, see if they broke one. If not, it's going to be a tie, and they will have a two-game lead not only on Seattle, but on New Orleans, who has two losses, and Green Bay, who has two losses. Instead, Kyle Shanahan let Jimmy G. They got the ball with a minute 50, and Seattle having no timeouts. Seattle got the ball back with a minute 25 because they dropped Jimmy G back three times to throw three deep passes, which led to the ultimate game-winning field goal. So I just, for San Francisco, this is a really tough loss for a number of reasons. One is you had a 10-0 lead. Mm-hmm. Another is this was the concern the skeptics had. If someone finds a way to shut down your best in the NFL running game, what is your counterpunch going to be? And all of a sudden, 8-0 can turn into 9-5 real quick when you still have another game left against Seattle, you play New Orleans, you play Green Bay, and by the way, you have to go to Baltimore. So I want to give credit to Seattle, who continues to be spectacular in a year people thought was going to be a down year, and Russell Wilson's going to win the league MVP, mm-hmm. or at least right now it looks like it. But San Francisco, this was a tough loss that should have been, worst case scenario, a tough tie, and they blew that opportunity.
Yeah, it was a tough loss, and the play calling by Kyle Shanahan in overtime in that second possession was inexplicable and it's unexcusable. But as far as Jimmy G goes, I mean, that's who Jimmy G is when you take away some of his best weapons. Remember, you had no George Kittle last night. He wasn't available due to injury. Emmanuel Sanders
left in the second quarter.
He left in the second quarter. And then, oh, by the way, Matt Breida was dealing with something, so you didn't have him to be that 1-2 punch with Tevin Coleman. So, I mean, this is who Jimmy Garoppolo is. If he has to throw you into games, you're going to be put in situations where he's going to make some mistakes and he's going to get exposed. You couple that with the Seattle Seahawks defensive line rounding into form and those guys finally being able to get after it. I think last night is exactly what you're going to get. The San Francisco 49ers are built to play a specific brand of football. They're built to be able to get the lead and extend the lead. They're not a team that's built to play from behind, and I think you saw that in the second half of yesterday's game.
Just quickly, especially, you saw Emmanuel Sanders playing really well early. He leaves with a rib injury, and the only place we saw George Kittle was in the owner's box pounded on the glass. Like, so to be fair to them, they also were without their two best weapons in order to be able to play from behind or to be able to mount something through the passing attack. Those guys were up.
And Emmanuel Sanders will have an MRI today. It's not like it was a bruise and he'll just rest. It might actually be something worse. But I think what a lot of people looked at the Seattle team and thought, well, it's Russell Wilson doing everything and then everyone else sort of around him. And last night, for the first time, you saw their defense really show up. You saw their offense play in addition to whatever Russell Wilson was doing. And now you look at the NFC West and you say, all right, the Niners, who had an incredible season, are 8-1, but they're the Seahawks at 8-2. What is this say now about the picture in the NFC West?
Well, listen, I picked the Seahawks coming into this season to win that division. They were a wild card team from a year ago. They had no business being in the playoffs, but that was in large part thanks to Russell Wilson, who last year had 35 touchdowns to 7 interceptions, and he's off to that kind of start again this year. And of course, the late game heroics that we always see from him, always giving his team a chance at the end of games. He's always going to be able to do that, but the biggest question was, what was that defense going to be like? And up until about a month ago, in large part, it's been a pedestrian group. You look at all the defensive metrics. I mean, this was average to below average. But then their general manager, John Snyder, decided to make a couple of decisions. He decided to trade for Jadeveon Clowney. You're starting to see that pay dividends now. He traded for Quandre Diggs a few weeks ago. A leader in that secondary, somebody that can help to reshape the identity of that back end. You saw that pay dividends last night. Jaron Reed, who's back in a disruptive force, he had in a sack and a half. So, I mean, if that defense continues to do what it's doing and continues to progress the way that it has, and they continue to develop chemistry, I mean, this Seahawks team is not only a team that could win the NFC West, but you're talking about them being a championship contender.
They're one of the six best teams in football. It's hard to argue against that right now. And I'm really glad you mentioned John Schneider, because you have the sustained success of 20 years in New England. And it's the greatest coach ever. It's the greatest quarterback ever. It's the greatest stretch in NFL history with respect to the Steelers in the 70s, the Niners in the 80s. What New England's done over 20 years is the best. But the last half of those 20 years, Seattle's doing something not equally as impressive, but pretty damn close on the other coast of the country. Not only because they have Russell Wilson, not only because they have Pete Carroll, but because of John Schneider and the way he builds that team, a down year for them is 9-7. Because they make moves like they trade away Frank Clark and get a 1-2, and they bring in Jadeveon Clowney and only give up a 3. Those are organizational moves that change the structure of your team. Frank Clark gets a monster deal from the Chiefs. They also have to pay up a first and a second. Seattle has Clowney on a one-year rental, only paying half his salary. They give up a third-round pick for him. That's what great organizations do. When you also have a future first-ballot Hall of Fame quarterback pulling the trigger for you, that's how you can be. You look at their roster and you're like, they're a good team, but not a good. Who's this Hollister kid he's throwing to? Oh, and they're 8-2 and a half game out of the lead in the NFC West with now the tiebreaker over San Francisco.
Thanks to that great team, the 49ers are no longer undefeated, and somewhere out there, the 72 Dolphins are cheering and celebrating. All right, on to the NFC East now. 7 weeks left in the regular season. We know the division will come down to a two-team race. Eagles and Cowboys both sitting at 5-4, but with Dallas coming off a loss and the Eagles stringing two wins together, Jerry Jones knows, quote, Philadelphia is coming. Chris Caney, who will win the NFC East? You think the Cowboys or the Eagles?
I'm still leaning toward the Cowboys just because the Cowboys have had so much success in the Dak Prescott, Zeke Elliott era against the Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, you look at their last 10 matchups, it's been one-sided affair. And the Dallas Cowboys, this team, finds ways to be able to give the Philadelphia Eagles fits, and it starts with Ezekiel Elliott. I think everybody understands that he's the engine for that offense, but in that game on Sunday night, Jenna, Mike Zimmer and the Minnesota Vikings defense, they were intent on taking Zeke away from the Dallas Cowboys, and they did, and Dak Prescott couldn't go out there and beat him, although he played a magnificent game. It came down to Jason Garrett and his play calling, or lack thereof, in the final 2 minutes of the game for inexplicably handing the ball to Ezekiel Elliott twice, being down by 4 points. It just didn't make any sense. Those two runs had a negative 3 yards net. So I look at this situation when everybody knows that they're trying to take Zeke away. What can Dak Prescott and that Dallas Cowboys offense do? And so far, they haven't been able to answer that question in the affirmative, at least not to the level that you would expect a championship contender. So for me, after last Sunday's game, I still had the same questions about the Dallas Cowboys going into the second half that I had coming into the season, which is, can Jason Garrett be the difference in a positive way when you're playing against quality competition? Can this team overcome adversity and injuries when you're not whole? Can you go out there and play at a high level against good competition? And then can Dak Prescott consistently play at a championship level? Those are still the three questions that have yet to be answered in a positive way for the Dallas Cowboys. We're hoping to see it at some point, but Jenna, up until this point in the season, they haven't shown us anything that would lead us to believe that those questions are going to be answered in a positive way.
But you're still leaning them slightly. Is that
I'm
correct?
Still leaning that way slightly just by default, but because the Philadelphia Eagles have been so inconsistent this season as well.
Well, and to your point about Dallas dominating Philly in the Dak Zeke era, Zeke's never lost to Philly. 5-0 in his career in the five games. He's obviously missed a couple of them that they've played since he's come into the league. Here's the reason why I'm still with Philadelphia. And I was with Philadelphia before the year. They were so disheartening early. You wanted to abandon them, but they were never able to lose contact with Dallas. I think Philly could lose to Dallas in Week 16 and still win this division. Mm. I don't think that any longer they have to get the split. I think that you look at Philly and you say, okay, in the final seven games, they have four games that, even as inconsistent as they've been, you'd be shocked if they lost. Those games are, of course, against Miami, two games against the Giants, and Washington. So if they're sitting at five wins, if they just have to not fall all over themselves to get to nine, then even if they lose to Dallas, they can win this division. Now, whoever wins this division is going to be a 9 or 10 win team that is going to be at home in the first round against an 11 or 12 win team that doesn't win the NFC West. One of those teams we saw last night is going to end up being an overqualified wild card team, probably a road favorite in the first round of the playoffs against one of these two teams. But Dallas, Philly is already through the gauntlet of their schedule. Dallas is just now beginning the gauntlet of their schedule, which is why them both being 5-4, even with Dallas right now having the head-to-head, to me that favors Philadelphia. And the other name you mentioned that I think is a huge, right now, a huge feather in Philly's cap, is the head coach of the Cowboys, Jason Garrett. And Doug Peterson might not be the top five coach he appeared to be after they won the Super Bowl, but I trust Doug Peterson in game management. I trust Doug Peterson as far as understanding how to put his team in tight spots at the end in a better position than I trust Jason Garrett. The Cowboys this year, 0-3 in one-score games. They had a close one against New Orleans, couldn't pull it off. They had a close one where they could have forced overtime against the Jets, and if they force overtime, they win that football game against the Jets, in my estimation. Mm-hmm. And they throw a pass to Jason Witten, and then 2 days ago, they have the game against Minnesota, which is there for the taking, and Dak said it after the game. I missed this yesterday, but I read the quote this morning. After the game, Dak said, yeah, I think, you know, we don't want to leave too much time on the clock there for Philadelphia, or for Minnesota, but you're worried. That is the ultimate definition of putting the cart before the horse. Score. The time, you got to score.
Exactly.
You
got to
get points and then worry about leaving.
And in fact, while you're trailing, you need to score as quickly as possible, because if you don't score, keep in mind, Dallas did get the ball back, but they only had 17 seconds. Mm-hmm. Had they not been as worried about grinding the clock, even if they fail on that second, third, and fourth down, maybe they have 45 seconds left, maybe they have a minute left for Dak to try to pull off some heroics. So even though thus far this season, Dak has been better than Carson Wentz, and that was an advantage that I gave to Philadelphia going into the year. Holistically, as a total, I still believe in the Philadelphia Eagles more.
I think a lot of people would say at the beginning of the season that Carson Wentz would probably somehow edge out Dak Prescott at least a little bit, just from what we've seen the last couple years. Take the head-to-head out of it. Mm-hmm. You look at both of these teams, they're both stacked at the skill positions. They both got tons of talent, and yet both teams have been so inconsistent this season. Does it come down to the quarterbacks and who you trust more down the stretch?
Well, here's the thing. I think Carson Wentz, from an ability standpoint, just has more than Dak Prescott. But the conversation is about the intangibles. Which quarterback is able to bring out the best in his guys most consistently? And I'd probably lean slightly toward Dak in that regard. Now, as far as Carson Wentz, the questions have been about his being able to stay healthy for his team and be available. But if these two guys are both healthy, then, yeah, I think it'll be a closely contested race, and it'll come down to that Week 16 matchup. But the Dallas Cowboys, to me, the biggest question is the head coach. And Nick talked about some of the sequencing with play calling. But, I mean, you had the first possession in that fourth quarter against the Vikings where you had the ball first and goal at the six-yard line. You got to settle for a field goal. Or even going back to the first possession that you had in the game where you get the ball in plus territory and you try to go for Brett Maher, 57-yard field goal that ends up being wide left by 18 feet. I mean, in that situation, you have to think, if you've got second and six, maybe this might be four down territory. But again, it goes back to the overall game management of Jason Garrett. And I think that's why we see some question marks regarding his future in Dallas and why Jerry Jones has not given him the contract extension. Jerry Jones is not sold on Jason Garrett continuing to be his head coach, because a good head coach finds ways for his team to be more competitive consistently, and a good head coach finds ways to put his team in position to win football games, and the Dallas Cowboys have not done that routinely throughout the course of this season.
To answer your question directly, Jenna, thus far this season, Dak's been head and shoulders better than Carson Wentz.
Yes.
Like when you look at the numbers, if the Cowboys were just 6-3, let's say they had just won the Jets game, then Dak's name would be included in that second tier MVP conversation so far this year, because the numbers, he's top five in the league in nearly every relevant passing category. So I want to give him credit for that. The reason I can't trust Dallas, aside from the head coach, is because aside from the Philly win, their wins have come over four wins against three terrible teams. Two against the Giants, one against Miami, and the one that I'm leaving out that was against Washington. So if they are going to get to the nine wins they need, even if we give them the Philly win, okay, they also get Washington. Let's give them those two wins. Detroit has not been an awful team this year. We'll see if Stafford's back. They have New England. They have Buffalo. They have Chicago, who's a live team, assuming Trubisky doesn't kill them. And the Rams, who, while wildly underachieving, they have a winning record thus far this season. Like, the Cowboys are going to have to do in the second half something they were totally unable to do in the first half.
Right.
Beat some good football teams, and I don't know that I believe they can.
Right on to the New England Patriots, with an AFC best 8-1 record, with the best coach to ever coach the game, and perhaps the best quarterback to ever play it. The Patriots are seemingly on track to go all the way again this year, but Tom Brady, in year 20, knows a thing or two about what it takes to win. And so when he said this week, quote, "We're really going to have to ramp it up," it gave us pause. Kenny, what needs to change for the Patriots coming off their bye? They have the Eagles now coming up, well-rested, getting ready to take on Philadelphia.
Well, Jenna, when Tom Brady said they need to ramp it up, he wasn't talking about the defensive side of the ball, because the defense has been balling, with the exception of that Sunday night game against the Ravens a couple of weeks ago. But offensively, this has been an average group. I mean, I know they're second in points, but, I mean, you look at it, they haven't been able to run the ball. I think they're somewhere in the 20s with that. And then Tom Brady in that passing attack, they're in the teens. So in terms of what we've come to know, a Tom Brady-led Patriots offense, it hasn't looked like that. And we're just trying to figure out, okay, what's their identity going to turn into this season? Last year, at the end of the year, end of November, beginning of December, Bill Belichick went to a two-back set on offense. They wanted to run the football. It was going to be old school, gap blocking, lead play, hard ball runs, that type of thing, and they were able to ride that to a championship. This year, I don't know where that's coming from. I mean, there is no Rob Gronkowski to be that physical presence at the tight end spot, not only in the passing game, but the run game. There is no dominant number one wide receiver out there that you can have mismatches against the defense with. So I don't know where it's going to come from. Now, they made the trade for Mohamed Sanu, so you got to think with the bye week, they'll have him fully integrated into the offense. Julian Edelman being a little bit healthier, we'll see what their rookie N'Keal Harry ends up being. But, I mean, the offense is going to have to pick it up if this team has championship aspirations. We just saw a Baltimore Ravens defense, who had been an average defense throughout the course of this season, make the Patriots offense make them look dominant on Sunday Night Football. So I think that offense is going to have to step up if the Patriots are going to get where they want to go.
Tom Brady knows what I know, what Canty knows, what everyone except for the parochial Patriot fan knows. This offense is mediocre. They are second in the league in points. That is the only, and you might say, well, that's all that matters. But even that's misleading, because they are 14th in the league in points per drive. So how are they second in the league in points? Well, because you get all these extra drives because your defense turns everyone over.
Or your defense just scores on their own.
Well, that, by the way, they're averaging 30 points per game as a team, but only 25 of those are on the offense because you're getting 5 points per game, which is an insane number from your defense or your pump block touchdown, special teams touchdowns. They're 15th in yards per game. They're 22nd in yards per play. On a per play basis, on a per drive basis, this is an average or below average offense. And Brady also knows that for a brief, there's only two periods of time where the Patriots this season have to play in the real NFL. Right now, this next month, and started a week ago against Baltimore, and then the playoff run, however long that is. In route two, their 8-0 start, they played two teams who now have a winning record. Only one of them had a pulse at the time. One of those teams is Pittsburgh. But Pittsburgh in week one, way different than Pittsburgh right now. Ben Roethlisberger was having him playing quarterback on an elbow that was hanging by a shred, and they didn't have Minkah Fitzpatrick. Devin Bush wasn't the player that he is in his first NFL game now, halfway through the season. And Buffalo. Buffalo's been basically the same team all year long. Excellent defense, limited on offense, going to try to beat you in a close game. And that game was 16-10. They now play Houston, well, Philly, as you mentioned, Dallas, Houston, Kansas City. Four legitimate teams. And here's the other thing Brady knows. Right now, the division leaders in the AFC, which quarterback is Brady playing better than? Is he playing better than Lamar Jackson?
No.
No. Is he playing better than Deshaun Watson?
No.
No. Is he playing better than Patrick Mahomes? No. So the Patriots, their defense can be the best in the AFC. But how much better does it have to be?
But not good enough to make it up for what they're getting on that.
Right. The offense doesn't have to be a top five offense. But right now, it's a middle of the pack offense in most of the major categories, aside from the one, points per game, which can be misleading. That offense needs to creep its way somehow over the last half of the year into the top 10. Because also, that offense has been taking advantage of the soft schedule as well and hasn't been able to fully take advantage. So Brady is right on this. And he knows that the record can be misleading. An 8-1 for the New England Patriots is misleading when you consider six of those wins came against teams that are not competent NFL teams.
And the truth is, they're not getting Gronk back. It's not like some magic is going to show up. Although they may get N'Keal Harry back. Over
but
the
we don't know if he's a good player.
We don't. We also don't know if Isaiah Wynn is a good player, but we've heralded him as the next.
Back-to-back first-round pick.
All right, Nick, is Russell Wilson running away with the Most Valuable Player Award?
I say absolutely yes. Now there's almost as much of the season left as we've played. There's 7 weeks left in the year. For Seattle, it's 6 games. So an enormous amount can happen, obviously. But through 10 weeks, he's the favorite if you want to gamble on it, and he should be the overwhelming favorite for the voters. Now, I felt like, I don't believe in jinxes, but if I did, I would have felt like I jinxed Russ yesterday because he's playing a brilliant game, making no mistakes. They're about to win in overtime. I tweet, he's running away, with respect to Lamar Jackson, it's Russell Wilson and nobody else is close. As I hit send, he throws the one bad pass.
So it was your fault.
I don't believe in those types of things, but the timing was spooky on it. Here's how great he's been. That mistake was shocking. I couldn't believe it happened. No matter, Patrick Mahomes, the guy we were just talking about, it's not shocking when he makes a mistake. You expect him to overcome it, mm-hmm. but every other quarterback in football, you're like, okay, you know, not once a game, but once every couple of games. So he might put the ball on the ground, might have a misread. Russell Wilson's made two mistakes this year that I can remember off the top of my head. The pass that Marcus Peters picked off mm-hmm. and took the other way, which was an enormous moment in that football game, and the play last night that he found a way to overcome. And he's doing it once again, Canty, with not a who's who, but a who's that? Like this Hollister kid out of Wyoming, yep. I'm not familiar with his work. He had turned Disley into a Pro Bowl level tight end before he
Tyler
pops
Lockett, we weren't talking about.
Tyler Lockett, he started to lean on last year and turning Lockett into a number one receiver in this league. He loses Doug Baldwin, no problem. DK Metcalf, be the most productive rookie wide receiver this mm-hmm. year. Josh Gordon yesterday. Two huge third downs. Russ puts it where he can't drop the football. And so the Seattle Seahawks this year, this is a pretty shocking number. Seven times they've allowed their opposition to score at least 24 points. The NFL teams this year win 28% of those games. They are 5-2, the best record in the league in those situations by far. You know why? Because through 10 weeks, they have the best player in the league, the player who's playing the best in the league and the best quarterback in the league, and that's Russell Wilson.
You know what? And probably the most impressive part of Russell Wilson's performance last night was surviving that 49ers defensive line who had three third down sacks. I think he was sacked a total of five times. But they were getting after Russell Wilson, but it didn't faze him, Jenna.
Nope.
He found a way to make plays when his team needed him to. That overtime drive, that was his fifth game-winning drive this season, 28th of his career. I mean, Russell Wilson has routinely done this. So when you have the conversation about the best quarterbacks or the most valuable players, I mean, I have a hard time believing that if you take Russell Wilson off of his team, that you can just, I'll put it to you this way. Russell Wilson means more to the Seattle Seahawks than almost any other player in the National Football League means to their team. I mean, the replacement level of Russell Wilson is, it would be tough to do. The Seattle Seahawks, if you were to take him off of that team, they're not a playoff team. But because he's their quarterback, you're talking about them being a championship contender. Now, I know you don't like to look at wins and losses as a quarterback record, but in this situation, I think it's applicable just because Russell Wilson routinely puts his team in position to be able to win games. And even though he made that mistake, the interception in overtime, which never happens, by the way, that's only the second time in the last 25 seasons, Russell Wilson finds a way to overcome it. And so that's why I have to look at this Seattle Seahawks team, especially the way that the defense is playing, through a different lens than I did in the first half of this year.
When you look at Lamar, Mahomes, Rodgers, Brady, you can look at each of them and say, oh, I know what they do really, really well. I know what makes them special. But what makes Russell Wilson so good? Is it the accuracy? Is it his mobility? Is it his intelligence? What makes him such a great player?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of those things, but Russell Wilson has this knack for being able to extend the down and allow his receivers time to uncover. Nick talks about the cast of characters that he's working with and not having any dominant skill position players. Well, I mean, those guys all of a sudden become a lot better when your quarterback is buying you an extra second or two to uncover downfield from defenders. Guys get lost. I mean, they run the scramble drill, and Russell Wilson has the ability to be able to find those guys. And Jenna, it always feels like Russell Wilson is playing within himself. It doesn't feel like a defense can get him rattled. He doesn't do things in terms of making mistakes at critical points in the game. And even though we saw it last night, he was able to overcome it. So to me, that's probably the thing that makes him special when you start talking about the best quarterbacks in the game, having that ability to elevate the play of everybody around him.
And when it comes to intangibles, Russell Wilson, and I mean this seriously, I'm not poking fun. Russell Wilson believes he's been touched by God in this regard, and he makes other people believe it. He makes believers out of non-believers because of his everlasting faith that we're going to be fine.
He's an evangelist now?
No, but he, if you listen to him after the game,
he
honestly, dating back to the comeback against the Packers in the NFC Championship game, the things that he says, even if you don't believe, you're like, I mean, he believes it so much. Yeah. I'm going to try to do this in 60 seconds here quickly. I'm glad people are finally catching up to this, because this is who Russell Wilson's been every day of his NFL career. In 2012, he comes in as a rookie, leads them to the playoffs. They're down 14-0 in the first round of the playoffs, leads a comeback for a win. Divisional round, same year as rookie year. They're down 10-0 at halftime. With 30 seconds left in that game, they're up 28-27, only don't win because of a Matt Bryant field goal. The next year, they win the Super Bowl. The next year, they're a yard away from winning the Super Bowl. His fourth year, they get back to the divisional round. He leads the NFL in passer rating. The following year, his now fifth year, they're in the divisional round again. His sixth year, he leads the NFL in touchdown passes. It's a rebuilding year for Seattle. They still are above 500. His seventh year, they go back to the playoffs. He has 35 touchdowns, 7 interceptions, and a 111 passer rating. And this year, he's going to win the damn league MVP. This is a guy, the trajectory of one of the greatest players in league history. And we are seeing it on full display. And if you've been paying attention, we've been seeing it since the day he stepped onto the training camp field and took that job from Matt Flynn.
It's such a good point. And so much when we talk about Tom Brady is who Tom Brady is, but he's had the benefit of working with Bill Belichick. Russell Wilson's had the benefit of working with Pete Carroll, and together they are probably the second best quarterback coach tandem in the league right now. Here, first things first, we're joined by Yahoo senior NBA writer Vincent Goodwill. Good morning,
Vince.
Fresh
cut.
Good morning.
What's happening?
They don't cut hair in New York like they do in Detroit.
Wow. Okay. That's a take.
That's a little disrespectful.
How so?
I'm a native New Yorker. Don't do that.
My condolences.
Doing that.
Wow.
Really?
Vinny's out here with the. But you got a good haircut.
I found one. I found one. I would have imported if I could. Trust me.
Yeah.
I don't know who you've been hanging around.
People who keep my hairline intact at 35.
We're gonna just pause from this, and as exciting as it is, talk about something equally as exciting. Last night, all eyes on Kawhi taking on his former team, the Raptors, last night. To say the Claw did not put up a championship performance could be an understatement, finishing just 2 of 11 from the field, to go along with 9 turnovers. Yet the Clippers still managed to get the win over Toronto, 98-88. After the game, Kawhi was thankful for his time with the Raptors, but also ready to move on.
It's over now. We won. Like I said before, I had a great time there. But, it's the next chapter now. I can't live in the past and just be so excited that I still won. I'm with a different team, a different unit, and they want to have that same feeling, and I do as well. So, I'm a Clipper right now. We're trying to win.
Vincent, if you take last night's stat line out of it, if you take load management out of it, all of that, will Kawhi carry the Clippers on a title run much the way he did when he was in Toronto?
I think so. They were my preseason pick to win the NBA title. And I know, Nick, you're not a fan of that. But the way I see it, with the way that they play defense, when you add in Paul George, who's yet to play, who's supposed to play in the next couple of nights, let's assume he gets back to form. You have two versatile wings who can take pressure off of each other, who can create their own shots. That's not to say that I don't have questions about them, because a combination of Lou Williams, Pat Beverly in the back court in the fourth quarter of games, and not necessarily a traditional stable point guard, especially on a night where Kawhi can have 9 turnovers and you don't have a secondary ball handler who can take the ball out of his hands or make things a little bit easier for him. That gives me a little bit of pause. But that defense there at that position, at the money position, to be able to guard a guy like LeBron James or James Harden or someone of that ilk, that gives me the most confidence even amongst the question marks that I have there. And I do think that load management plays a part, because I believe Kawhi will be fresher than some of these other guys later down the stretch of the season.
Just real quick to follow up on the defense, what should be noted, if people haven't really checked in fully on the NBA yet, is the Clippers, who I think everyone at this table predicted would have at worst a top 3 defense in the NBA. I think most people thought it'd be Clippers and Sixers battling out for number 1 defense. The defense been average so far this year. Mm-hmm. Last night notwithstanding, they went into last night's game with the 14th ranked defense in basketball. Their offense has, it's been very odd. The Lakers have been carried by their defense mm-hmm. while their offense have struggled. The Clippers have been carried by their offense while their defense has struggled. My only concern for the Clippers defensively is that what we have seen, and by the way, we saw this with Kawhi his last healthy year in San Antonio, was when you have to do the lion's share of the work on the offensive end, your defense suffers. This is something that's always been unfair about what people say about Harden, except for when he was just not even caring on defense, was you have such a workload on one end of the court. LeBron this year, by the way, has a lighter workload on offense because of Anthony Davis, and color me shocked, his defense has been exceptional, the best in years. Do you have any concern that the Clippers' defense is going to be more hype than reality by the time we get to the end of the year?
No, because you're bringing in a guy that I voted in on my second on my ballot as defensive player of the year last year, and Paul George. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at a guy like Kawhi Leonard, to me, it's almost like a shutdown corner. You take away their best player. So then it's 4-on-4. And if your other four defenders aren't as good, then the defensive numbers aren't going to look as good. It's on Kawhi and the Clippers to sort of bring that back to the middle a little bit, have him be more of a help defender as opposed to just the shutdown guy that can snatch everything away. I think that was the problem in San Antonio, where people would just take away that player from that side of the floor and not even use him and then go 4-on-4. And that's not anybody's fault.
No, you're absolutely right. And Paul George being out is a huge piece of this equation, because you traded a lot of your depth to be able to get Paul George in the first place. No Shake Gilgeous Alexander, no Danilo Gallinari. So you have to look at this team. When they do have Kawhi Leonard on the court, their defensive rating is 94.7. That would be best in the NBA. So you're looking at the bench players for the Clippers, who are such a huge part of what they do on the offensive end. Those guys continuing to have that same intensity on the defensive side of the court. I do believe that that's something that gets worked out once they figure out what their identity on the offensive side of the court is going to be. A lot of times with teams, when they're struggling offensively, it affects what they do on the other side of the court. So I don't have any concerns in terms of the Clippers figuring that part of it out. But the one thing that Kawhi Leonard said in that soundbite that I held on to was the fact that he said it's a different team, it's a different unit. That may well be true, but the philosophy is still the same in terms of how this team is going to have to compete for a championship, much in the same way that the Toronto Raptors did. It's going to have to be about depth in defense. That's going to have to carry them to the title. Last night, they shot 37% from the field, but guess what? They beat the Raptors on the board 66-38 and outscored them on the bench 56-35. If you can do that, you'll give yourself a chance against anybody in this league.
I want to go back for a moment, though, to your original question. Because I think there's a flaw in it to a degree, which is, can he carry the Clippers to a title like he did the Raptors? Kawhi was sensational in the postseason last year, the best player in the playoffs. No one can deny that. But I don't think it's fair to say he carried Toronto to the NBA title, to the NBA championship. Just like it wouldn't be fair to say, we'll see what happens this season. But the Raptors, as they proved the year before they got Kawhi, and as they're proving right now, are an excellent organization with incredible depth. They won 59 games and were the one seed the year before Kawhi got there. Now, they got knocked out by the best player in the world, but that's no shame in that. This year, despite a litany of injuries, despite guys being dinged up early in the season, they are 7-3 and simply ran out of gas last night. They're playing on a back-to-back. The Clippers, obviously not. Like, most of these championship-level teams or teams that are even in the category for it, yeah, they have a star player, but all of them in recent history, except for LeBron teams, they are good enough organizationally that when the star leaves, they're okay. KD leaves, that team could have won the title. Without him, they're still a playoff team. Kyrie leaves, the Cavs, they go back to the finals. He leaves the Celtics. They're still, right now, they have the best record in basketball. Hell, Kawhi leaving the Spurs, they still made the playoffs last year. Like, we have, the Raptors were not Kawhi Leonard and friends. They were an exceptional team, and we're seeing Pascal Siakam becoming his full version of himself right now before our very eyes. So if the Clippers are going to win the title, it's going to be similarly to how the Raptors did it. Kawhi might be the leading actor, but that is an all-star cast around him, along with the great head coach like they had in Toronto.
Well, I would take umbrage with you saying with the exception of LeBron, because a year after LeBron left Miami, those Miami Heat were a game away from making the Eastern Conference Finals.
No, the year he left Miami, they missed the playoffs.
The year after.
So two years after.
The full year after, after the Chris Bosh injury and everything else. So they were a good organization. Now to say that Kawhi can't carry them, carry to me means in the last 5 minutes, we know where the ball is going. We know who's getting the ball. It's just a matter of, are you going to stop us and can we stop you? And I think that is Kawhi's strength. Now, Kawhi, we didn't pick Toronto to win the NBA Finals last year.
No.
Once we got there, once we knew, even with Kevin Durant being out and we weren't sure if he was coming back, we didn't pick them there. Now, Pascal Siakam was certainly a revelation, along with Fred VanVleet and all those other parts. But Kawhi Leonard was that guy. Don't take away that credit from him. I'm not taking away that he didn't do it.
On the playoff run, he carried him. I will absolutely, no question. Listen, from that moment to starting in game three against the Bucks to the entire NBA Finals, I am not removing any of that. The point I'm making is that that Raptors team and the Masai Ujiri had been building a legitimate contender for years. And Canny, as we're seeing this year, that remains even when Kawhi Leonard walks out the door for no compensation.
Yeah, you have to have the infrastructure in place before you can compete for a championship. They have the saying, players win games, but organizations win championships. I think that would be true with the Raptors case last year, and I think that would be true with the Clippers if indeed they're able to finish the drill this year and get it done. I mean, because the Clippers have been building to this point for some time now, it just so happens that the timing matched up. They had the assets, and Kawhi Leonard had the interest where they were able to make this deal happen. But, I mean, anything short of a championship for the Clippers, and it's a disappointing season. So I don't think the Clippers could be an organization that has championship aspirations realistically without Kawhi Leonard. So when you say Kawhi Leonard has to carry them to the championship, I would tend to agree with that statement just because they're not winning one without it.
And just very, very briefly, credit to Kawhi last night, despite the really rough night, one assist away from his first career triple-double, which I assume at some point he'll get this season, and kept his double-digit.
That is some nice shade there, Nick.
What are you talking about?
That is a kidney punch.
One assist away, he's going to get a
kidney punch.
Okay, I mean, he's going to get a triple-double at some point this year, and credit to him for that. And he kept his double-digit point streak alive in 75 games now, which I think's 862. Too short of the
see how every shade. See how so everything shade. Comes what? Back to LeBron.
He
everything.
Finds a what new you, and creative way to shade LeBron's Kawhi name. Leonard.
Coach, how did the Seahawks win this one last night?
Well, there were a couple things that went into this. One thing I really like about Seattle is their willingness to continue running the ball and their commitment to the running game and things that helps them do. And they did that fairly effectively last night. They did a good job of stopping San Francisco from running the ball, but it came down to turnovers. And really in the second half, when you look at San Francisco's body of work, that first drive, they went out on downs. And then the next drive, it was the fumble that set up a touchdown. And the next drive, it was the interception that set up the touchdown. It was those turnovers that just created situations that was hard for them to dig out of. And they did a nice job too of forcing some turnovers, very uncharacteristic turnovers. But Seattle just did a better job with that at the end of the day.
Yeah, and when you have replacement-level players, sometimes you don't get the results you're looking for. San Francisco is a team that's built on your defense. And with your defense, you need a good special teams to be able to complement that. Last night, they really missed Robbie Gould. You saw what happened with Chase McLaughlin, the 47-yard field goal in overtime that he missed after making a 47-yard field goal in the fourth quarter to force overtime. So you have to count that as a huge loss and an opportunity or an advantage for the Seahawks. Also, no George Kittle, no Emmanuel Sanders. He went out in the second quarter with a rib injury, and then Matt Breida was nicked up. You didn't have the 1-2 punch in the backfield. Coach, to your point, Seattle Seahawks defense shut down that running game of the 49ers. That running game wasn't full strength. And so when it's not, you have to rely on Jimmy G to be able to throw you into a game. And when you have a deficit, you're playing from behind in the second half, he's not exactly the quarterback that you want to trust. And the Seattle Seahawks defense took advantage of all the miscues that the 49ers had. Now, Seattle had to overcome their own mistakes as well because they had four turnovers in this game. The DK Metcalf turnover right before halftime, which was a huge play.
So 7 points.
Jaquiski Tartt makes a great play stripping the ball out and being able to give them the ball at the two-yard line. You had the Chris Carson fumble. Then you had the Russell Wilson, Jermaine Ifedi fumble. Then you had the overtime interception. And yet somehow, some way, the Seahawks are able to overcome all of that on the road in order to win a game. And that really comes down to, for me, two things. the way that the defense played for the Seahawks, and then Russell Wilson being great in critical situations.
And what's amazing about that is on that third down in overtime, you knew the one thing that could really kill you there is a Russell Wilson scramble. And the D-line didn't have the lane integrity, and he scrambles for 18 yards. It's the one thing in that moment that you know
kills you.
You cannot let
and
happen.
And you know that is a huge part of his brilliance, is that this isn't a guy who surprised you with a scramble like Ryan Tannehill did the Chiefs a couple times. Like, this was a guy who has made an enormous part of his career doing exactly that.
Yeah, that's what you have to stop. You've got to force him to be a passer and be a consistent passer. Not that he's ineffective there. He's very dangerous there. But when he combines the moving plays and then the actual scrambles, it just breaks your back.
Nick, when you look at this 49ers team, they had almost everything working except there was one big question mark, and that was at quarterback. Yep. And I don't know coming off a great game and then what happened last night, he's inconsistent. And I know you were not on his corner coming. Where are you coming out?
A lot of people have great games against the Arizona Cardinals secondary, and that game last week was inflating his numbers to a degree. I think going into last week, he had 9 touchdowns to 7 interceptions. Then last week, he has a 4 touchdown game, no turnovers. And you're like, oh, okay, Jimmy G has maybe turned a corner. No, he hasn't. If the 49ers, now, to be fair, the loss of Emmanuel Sanders during the game was a killer, and not having George Kittle, who Kyle Shanahan says their best offensive player, and he's right, obviously is a killer. Kittle's one of the two best tight ends in football, he and Travis Kelce. He might be the best. But if you have to rely on Jimmy Garoppolo to win you football games right now, even though he has a 16-3 record for his career, you're going to be in trouble. And he looks skittish in the pocket. You mentioned the turnovers. He had 3. He could have had 7. Mm-hmm. He had 1 turnover, 1 interception that was taken away by penalty, a very questionable penalty. Looked like the receiver just fallen down. And then in the final drive of regulation, he tried to throw the ball to Seattle multiple times. And in overtime, the only players he was hitting accurately were Seattle Seahawks. And the Seattle Seahawks, every one of those linebackers and secondary guys needs to be on the jugs machine this week, because they could have ended this game multiple times, which is why I was shocked that Kyle Shanahan was as aggressive as he was after Seattle punted the ball away. First, I was minute 50 left, no timeouts. Seattle punts the ball away. That shocked me, because what you're saying there is we're fine with a tie, but when you are down 2 games in your division, you're not really fine with a tie. But for San Francisco to get the ball there, and if they run the ball once, even if they go 3 and out, Seattle's going to have less than a minute. If they run the ball twice, the game's over. Like, they're going to go home with the tie. And I'm curious, you, from a coaching perspective, how much this, what I'm about to show you, plays into the math here. San Francisco has to know what the record is, their standings going into the year. They have to know, obviously, that Seattle or that New Orleans had lost. And we can show you what the records would have been had they taken a tie, which is the right-hand side. They're 2 games clear of the entire NFC. And with a loss, they are now jumbled with everyone. And they self-play Green Bay, New Orleans, and Seattle again. As a coach, I know you play to win, but in that spot where if San Francisco wanted to, they could have taken a tie, Seattle could have done nothing about it, no timeouts. Were you surprised at all they were as aggressive as they'd been, with Jimmy G being as shaky as he'd been?
Yeah, I thought once they got the ball back, it was either going to be they won the game or it was a tie. I didn't think Seattle was going to get another chance at it. I didn't think there was any way Seattle was going to get another chance. I thought they'd at least run the ball one time. And even if Seattle got the ball back, it would be such a small window that it would be really difficult for them to do what they did. But everybody has a different philosophy. And oftentimes, offensive-minded head coaches like to be aggressive.
Go.
And they don't necessarily take into consideration the big picture. And then when you have a defense like they have, sometimes there's that thought process of we can be aggressive, because even if we punt it back, our defense is going to hold up and put us in position to...
And by the way, all ties are not created equal. Like we were talking about before the show, if San Francisco were the team with 2 losses and Seattle were undefeated, then I would have supported San Francisco being aggressive, because you're trying to catch up in the standings. But when you are the only undefeated team in football, in this odd spot, a tie is damn near as good as a win, because Seattle still has 2 losses to make up on you, as is San Francisco, I'm sorry, as is New Orleans and Green Bay. That's why it was so shocking to me, not just how Jimmy G was playing, but their positioning going into the football.
Well, sometimes when you're 8-0 and things are going your way the whole season long,
Roll it. Just assume it's
going to go your way again.
Listen, no matter what, the NFC is going to be fun down the stretch at this point.
And one of those two teams is going to be a wild
card. I don't know how you can assume that, Coach. In overtime, you want to trust your quarterback over Russell Wilson?
We're talking Patriots now with an AFC best 8-1 record, with the best coach to ever coach the game, present company excluded, and perhaps the best quarterback to ever play the game. The Patriots seemingly on track to go all the way again this year. But Tom Brady, in year 20, knows a thing or two about what that would take. And so when he said this week, quote, we're really going to have to ramp it up, well, we took a little pause. Mangini, what needs to change for the Patriots coming off the bye?
Well, he's exactly right. They do need to ramp it up. The level of competition over this next four games is changing, and we've seen that the last two games. The Browns gave them some problems and could have easily won that game outside of that period they had in the
three
first.
Three straight turnovers.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to overcome that. But you saw some cracks at that point, and then we saw what happened in Baltimore. Now they go four straight with really challenging opponents, and they've had difficulties. The problems on the offensive line are real. They're not going away. They're on their fourth left tackle over the last 3 years, and the injury at center, that has been really difficult to overcome. And you've got Mike Devlin, the tight end fullback. He's no longer there. The problems in the kicking game. But the O-line problems are showing up in the running game, especially where they're almost a yard less at this point in the season on average than they were last year. And that consistency in the running game allows them to set up so many other things. Now, the good news for them is that they do get N'Keal Harry back. Mohamed Sanu is getting more reps. He's getting more acclimated to the system. And I think Ben Watson hasn't been as productive as they've hoped, but he does give them a chance for some vertical speed down the field that
and someone that Brady trusts,
have.
It would appear.
He's reliable. He brings a different type of element to the passing game than what they had when Ben wasn't there. And then we'll see where Isaiah Wynn is and what he can contribute. But this next four-game stretch is going to look a lot different than what we saw in the early part of the season when they were playing teams that weren't very challenging.
Well, to me, it's about the four-game stretch, Coach, but it ain't about that. Because, I mean, you're playing against Philly, Dallas, Houston, and Kansas City. Three of those four games are in Foxborough, and we know how good Bill Belichick is at home going up against young quarterbacks. To me, this is more so about positioning themselves for the postseason. Because this team, this franchise, under Brady and Belichick, they understand, probably better than any other franchise in the National Football League, how important it is to be one of those top two seeds in your conference, to have an opportunity to be one of four teams with a chance to go to the Super Bowl out of the AFC as opposed to one of six. So having that first round bye, I don't think they made it to the Super Bowl without having a first round bye. So if they want to make it nine straight AFC championship games, this offense is going to have to turn around really quickly. Last year, we know their offense struggled for the first half of the regular season, and then they morphed into an offense that was going to be led by a two-back rushing attack. But you don't have that James Devlin presence in the backfield. You don't have Rob Gronkowski at tight end right now. So what
you
is
don't
this?
Have your center.
You
I
don't have
his name.
You don't have your center. I mean, Isaiah Wynn has been nicked up
Andrews.
Again. So you're dealing with a lot of injuries in your backfield and on your offensive line. It's a lot for them to overcome. And unless they have balance on the offensive side of the ball, unless they're going to be able to give Tom Brady some protection by running the football, then this offense is going to continue to struggle.
So that's just it. I mean, this is a team that if there's any team that makes changes in their bye week, if there's any team that changes what needs to, and Coach, you talk about they know who they are very early on in the season and you spend the first month or two trying to figure that out. Well, then you're like, oh, okay, well, they'll come out against the Eagles this week and we'll see a different offense. They're not getting Gronk back. We don't know who N'Keal Harry or Isaiah Wynn are going to be yet. So what changes, Nick? They can't scheme their way to be a productive offense. Go ahead.
Well, the only thing I'll say is the fact that they're getting N'Keal Harry back and Isaiah Wynn, we don't know what they are, but it's very rare that you get two first-round draft picks back in the middle of the season. That's a pretty significant influx of talent, or potential influx of talent. And then the Mohamed Sanu acquisition is important because it does give him another possession type receiver, reliable receiver to go to. Missing that tight end, it's part of that triangle, because they've had the back out of the backfield, the slot receiver, and the tight end, where Tom's really been able to work the middle of the field very effectively. And you had to make a decision defensively who you wanted to cover.
Sure.
Now with losing the tight end in that mix, it's down to those two guys, and that's been something that's been hard for them to overcome.
And to be clear, N'Keal Harry is eligible to come back this week against Philly. Isaiah Wynn's going to have to wait another week until Dallas. And by the way, I don't expect Isaiah Wynn to immediately come in and become their starting left tackle, just like I don't expect N'Keal Harry to come in and immediately be their starting X receiver. Maybe by the end of the season, week 14, 15, either one of those guys could be in those spots, because they've been searching at both those spots all year long. But the Patriots have played this year two teams that going into that football game had a winning record: Buffalo and Baltimore. Buffalo gave them all they could handle. And despite Josh Allen having a hat trick of turnovers and then getting injured, and Matt Barkley coming in and having a turnover himself, that's a 6-point margin of victory in a game the Patriots blocked a punt for a touchdown. Then Baltimore whooped them. Baltimore was up 17-0, about to be past the sticks time, up 24-0. And then the kid the Patriots used to have, Cyrus Jones, made a better play for the Patriots as a Raven than he ever made as a Patriot.
Is he still on the payroll for
right,
the Patriots?
And fumbled the punt, and all of a sudden, New England got back in that game, at least temporarily. Philly, for all their warts, is a real live football team. Dallas, for all their inconsistencies, when healthy, is a real live football team. Houston, Deshaun Watson has had one of the best games of his early career against New England, and then Brady drove him down, game-winning touchdown pass to Brandon Cooks in the front corner of the end zone that Cooks didn't actually catch, but it's the Patriots, so why review it, give him the win. And then Kansas City, who played him twice last year and had a lead in the fourth quarter both of those games. So I just want to see the Patriots beat the types of teams they are going to have to beat in the postseason. I do not doubt the defense. I do not doubt the coaching staff. I'd be a fool to. The offense has been mediocre, and I don't know that a couple guys who have never taken an NFL snap are going to be major difference makers. I do think Sanu is a significant addition, and we're going to see that throughout.
To the Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes returned from his dislocated kneecap to throw for over 400 yards and 3 touchdowns on Sunday. And according to reports, there were no issues for the reigning MVP in his return, unless you consider their loss an issue. And the fact that KC has dropped 4 of their last 6 an issue. Nick, do you have any real concerns for the 6-4 Chiefs at this point?
I certainly have more concerns about them than I did at the beginning of the year or than I did 5 weeks ago. Now, I have fewer concerns than I did going into that football game. And you might say, but they lost, and they lost in ugly, unforgivable fashion. They were 98% to win that game at one point.
Yeah, they found creative ways to lose that game.
100%. But the reason I'm a little more optimistic than I was before this weekend is the only path to a Super Bowl for the Chiefs is Patrick Mahomes being full-abled, Patrick Mahomes. And we saw that he is going to be that. That if he came out and was hobbled, or you could see...
Or limited at all.
Limited at all, then this becomes a very average football team. So that's a relief if you're a Chiefs fan or a Chiefs supporter. The concern for Kansas City is not what their upside is. It's they continue to show that what their downside is. And by that I mean this, Canny. I still believe the Chiefs can beat anybody. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. The Chiefs come out, they if you had the defense that you saw against Minnesota, the offense that you see every week Mahomes is out there, that is as good as any team in football. But they have also shown you now, home or away, they can lose to just about anybody. Not that the Titans are a terrible team, but they're no great team. They're not going to make the playoffs this year. And they found a way to lose that game. So I wouldn't be shocked if Kansas City in round 2 of the playoffs goes into Foxborough and wins that football game. But also right now, could you be shocked if in round one of the playoffs, they're hosting a wild card Colts team and Marlon Mack runs for a $1.85 and they go home there? So that's where my level of concern is, that the downside for this team is far greater than I thought it would be 10 weeks into the season.
Yeah, to me, that loss that they had in Tennessee almost assures that they won't have one of those top two seeds in the AFC.
Absolutely.
Which means more than likely in round two, in the divisional round, they're going on the road.
Yep.
And so that's the part of it that bothers me, just because their defense has been so inconsistent. I mean, they're relying on Pat Mahomes when he goes out there to be able to win a shootout. He's got to score 30-plus every single time for this team to have a chance. They've only got two wins this season where the team didn't score 30 points. In Pat Mahomes' 18 wins, they've only got five wins where they didn't score 30 points or more. So, to me, when you have to go out there and your quarterback has to do so much, that already puts you at a disadvantage, because you know once you get into the postseason, when teams become more game plan specific and there's more urgency because it's win or go home, you just don't have – it's hard to have to lean on your offense to be able to score so many points. You got to be able to line up and stop somebody. And I have serious questions about the Kansas City Chiefs' ability to do that against the better teams in the league. Now, we saw it against the Minnesota Vikings, so it's not like they haven't put it out there on tape, but it's too far and few between. So you need to see more consistency from that other side of the ball before I can trust them as a contender. So, yeah, they're asking Pat Mahomes to do a lot more than they should. And I think you saw a little bit of relax in that team overall, knowing that they were getting an MVP caliber quarterback back.
They also, though, have shown in the last 365 days, they've played four games against Baltimore and New England. They've beaten Baltimore twice. They've given Lamar his half of his career losses. And in New England, I know they were 0-2, but anyone watching those games, particularly the AFC Championship game, knows Kansas City just as easily could have won that football game as New England did. They had it won, and then Dee Ford had lined up offside. So I think they can go into either one of those places, which Canny's right. Because of that loss, they are now almost assured to have to go into one of those places and believe they can win. But they also could lose before they get there. Like, they could lose this weekend to the Chargers in Mexico City. I don't think they will, but they could. And the best teams in football, those head-scratching losses, are a once-a-year aberration. For Kansas City, that hasn't been the case. That's what's the most disappointing thing about them through 10 weeks of the season.
When the Lakers traded for six-time All-Star Anthony Davis to play alongside LeBron James, the sky was seemingly the limit. But with AD injuring his shoulder in just his third game as a Laker, expectations had to be reevaluated. And though the brow said his shoulder has gotten much better, he also said there's, quote, never a play that I don't feel it. So, Vince, could Davis's health keep the Lakers from winning a title?
Absolutely, it can. Because LeBron James is not at the stage anymore of his career where, in Nick's words, if Kawhi Leonard didn't carry a team to a title last year, we damn sure know LeBron James at year 17 can't carry a team to a championship anymore. So, if with that being said, Nick, and you look so confused. Are you okay?
No. The evidence would say you're wrong, but that's fine. I'll let you finish your point.
You look quite perplexed.
No, because what you said didn't make any sense. But go ahead. I'll let you finish your point.
You said Kawhi Leonard did not carry the Raptors to a title last year.
Yeah, because they had such a great roster, he didn't have to.
Okay.
Because they were a 59-win team the year before.
But that's not the position the Lakers are in right
now. Correct.
Exactly.
Right.
The Lakers are not in a position where LeBron James can carry them to a championship. Anthony Davis has to be a co-star, if not equal participant with LeBron as far as on the equity of how far this thing is going to go. That's no shade to LeBron. That's year 17 of wear and tear on his body. So Anthony Davis, being the player that he is, being defensively a player who can challenge LeBron to say, hey, you're going to have to step it up on defense because I'm stepping it up on defense. You're talking about the number one and two defensive players in the league as far as block shots per game, Anthony Davis and Dwight Howard. So, yeah, I think he's critically important to what the Lakers do, because there's no one else that can pick up that slack in the meantime. And with LeBron playing point, that takes so much out of him, Nick, that I don't think that's a good long-term position for him. They're going to have to lessen the usage so that they can stretch this thing out. Anthony Davis's health or notwithstanding.
The reason I look perplexed is because I can't
imagine. It's a consistent look.
I can't imagine anyone would disagree with a word you said, aside from the Kawhi stuff, which is irrelevant and didn't make sense. But aside from that, of course you have to have a fully functional Anthony Davis for this team to win a title. Like, that's the whole plan was LeBron comes to L.A. in year one, sees what's there, gets Luke Walton the hell out of here. He's doing a great job in Sacramento, by the way. And then you bring in your co-star. And that the co-star is this super freak is all the better. Now, maybe it is because of the shoulder. But I will also say this. Anthony Davis not only has to be healthy, he's got to be better than he's been these opening dozen or those opening 10 games of the year, 9 games of the year. The Lakers, with LeBron and Anthony Davis on the court together, are outscoring their opponents something absurd, like 16 points per 100 possessions. With LeBron on there without Anthony Davis, they're outscoring their opponents, so I think it's like 3.5 points.
Mm-hmm.
With Anthony Davis on there and not LeBron, they're getting outscored by a half dozen. Like, Anthony Davis is going to play a lot of minutes this year. The end of the first quarter, the end of the third quarter, and other times. Other moments with LeBron on the bench, and he needs to be able to carry the Lakers in those spots. I think he can. I think health has a part to do with it, and I think he's right now not totally comfortable in his role and his situation. He obviously is playing his best minutes at the five, but he hates it. He's in taking a lot of, even by his standards, more long jump shots than you would like. I think one of the reasons he's not getting down on the block is because of the shoulder. But if he's hurt, then they need to give him some time off at some point, because there, I agree with you 1,000% that in 2019, given the depth of the West, what LeBron did in 2017 with the Cavs, which is carry a team to the NBA Finals, that does not exist in the Western Conference. You have to have a co-star alongside him, and so that co-star has to be Anthony Davis. Kuzma will be better than he's been thus far, but it's not him. Danny Green is great in his role. Dwight's been great in his role. The only other star in this team is Anthony Davis. He's got to be healthy for them to have any shot. I agree 1,000%.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Anthony Davis has to be healthy. Now, I'm not going to be dismissive of Kuzma, because I do think he has to be that third wheel in this equation. But, I mean, yeah, LeBron James and Anthony Davis are going to have to take turns being the star, especially on the offensive side of that court for this team, because you don't really have any other guys that can create on that end of the court. Now, as far as what they're doing defensively, the numbers don't lie, Nick. They are a much better defensive team when they have LeBron James and Anthony Davis court, as opposed to when they don't have AD available. So I think you have to look at this situation as Frank Vogel weighing the importance of the regular season, especially being in a Western Conference, versus the importance of having a healthy AD once we get to May and we're talking about playoff basketball. I think the fact that he's being vocal about that, he verbalized that, that's a step in the right direction. But yeah, I don't feel good about a big man dealing with shoulder injuries this early in the season. So you have to watch this closely, because at some point you have to face the reality that you have a LeBron James in year 17, and at some point you're going to have to spell him during the course of the regular season. That's when you need Anthony Davis to step up, but it's going to be hard for AD to be able to do that if he's compromised health-wise.
And no one wants to start talking about load managing Anthony Davis, at least at this point moving forward.
Why not?
If he's hurt, it's not load managing. If he's hurt, if he has a shoulder injury and needs a week off, that's something that's happened the entirety of NBA history. Having scheduled days off to deal with a potential injury that may arise, that's where we get betwixt and between on load managing and injury managing.
But if it isn't Anthony Davis, what would keep this team from winning the title this year?
Well, I think when you look at the rest of the roster, when you look at the Avery Bradleys, the Rajon Rondos, the Kuzmas, all these other guys who have to fulfill specific roles on this team, Danny Green's to make shots or to play perimeter defense, to do all these things. LeBron has a great talent of making role players better than what they are, but he also has a great talent of making great players role players. So he has to find that balance, because so much runs through him. Nick brought up the net rating, and I don't think that's a fault of Anthony Davis. That's a fault of, with LeBron being the orbit, everything revolves around him. Everything is geared towards your team being best, because LeBron is at his best. So when he's off of the floor, other people don't know how to exist, even stars like Anthony Davis, because they're used to playing subservient roles.
And to your point, it's always been big guys that have had trouble adapting to a LeBron James type of offense, because LeBron doesn't want bigs in the paint.
Exactly.
If you look at it, Chris Bosh, Kevin Love, those guys have all...
He needs space.
Those guys have all, from a production standpoint, took a step back on LeBron James-led teams. But, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt in LeBron's mind. He needs Anthony Davis, and in order to get the most out of him, he's going to have to adjust his game a little bit as well.
Two very quick points. One is I don't think the Anthony Davis drop off in production is as much about the Lakers offense revolving around LeBron as much as it is he is the only competent playmaker they have right now. So when they don't have it with I don't love Rondo at this point in his career, but he at least is a good, he can run an offense. They don't, Quinn Cook has been terrible and they don't have, and Caruso is what he is. Like when LeBron's off the court, they don't have a guy they trust handling the ball. I disagree with the idea that the superstars have been lessened alongside LeBron. Third stars have been lessened alongside LeBron. Dwayne Wade was not lessened alongside LeBron. He was brilliant until his knee gave out. And Kyrie played the best basketball of his career alongside LeBron. That third star, it is a tough role for him. But Anthony Davis be the second star. And by the way, LeBron in year 17, 18, or 19, you plug him in on that Raptors roster last year with Lowry and Gasol and Siakam and
OG. How do we go back
all
there?
That,
right?
How do we
go back there?
They finally
have to go back there.
How do
we
figure out what the hell he was talking about. I'm like, wait, is he really saying that? Come on.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.